One New York restaurant now has just the thing. A $175 hamburger.
Chef Kevin O'Connell starts with well-marbled Kobe beef. It comes from pampered, beer-fed cows that get daily massages. Forget bacon. This one sports foie gras. The patty's cooked in the foie fat. And in shorts over the top, he sprinkles gold leaf.
The burger is very popular with the hedge fund crowd. Because $175 is a small price to pay to literally crap gold.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. My name is Phil, and I'm your host with the most beer and stuff. That song's by a band that I really dig, discovered them last year. She Wants Revenge. The song is called Someone Must Get Hurt. Check the website for a link to the iTunes store if you want to buy that, 99 cents. Zeroface.wordpress.com. They're a total throwback to the 80s. Joy Division, David Bowie. A bit like Interpol. Speaking of Joy Division, I saw Control on DVD last month, and it is a definite must-see for any fan of Joy Division or New Order. Not sure how many of you out there were into the 80s new wave and punk scene, but it's a very well-done film by Anton Corshin, who shot most of Depeche Mode's album covers and videos in the late 80s and early 90s. Control is his first feature film, and it covers the life of Ian Curtis, who was the lead singer of the punk band Joy Division in the late 70s and early 80s. Curtis couldn't take the pressures of being in a band, and the band was on the cusp of making it really big, and he committed suicide, hung himself. Of course, Joy Division went on to become New Order, which spawned other great electro-pop bands in the 80s. Anyway, if you're interested in the punk scene or movies about musicians in general, I can't suggest it enough. Control by Anton Corshin. Also, I wanted to mention all the exciting things going on with our friends over at Should I Drink That? ShouldIDrinkThat.com. Father Spoon and Sick Puppy are on absolute fire right now. They were featured in this month's Draft Magazine. A local newspaper in Pittsburgh got some really positive feedback from Smaltz Brewing, makers of the Hebrew, the chosen beer. They're having the giveaway to end all giveaways right now. It's a total package for a weekend in Erie. You get a hotel to stay at, a case of beer, a brewery tour, a job at the brewery, a new car, free year gas. Enter today, shouldidrinkthat.com. Not sure about the prizes. You'll find the details on the website, but check that out. I'm not sure I talked about this either when the news came down in May, but Food Network kicked Emeril Lagasse off their channel, off the network. And it's a move I never really thought they'd make. He kind of built that place. He literally put them on the map. This is how they thanked him, you know? Anyway, Martha Stewart bought the rights to his show. And she also got the rights to his books and stuff a few months ago. I think it actually maybe it happened late last year. So now from July 7th through the 11th, Fine Living Network is going to begin debuting his Emeril Live show with 5 new episodes. After this week of new shows, a new Emeril Live show will appear on Fine Living Network every Monday night, and they'll show all sorts of old episodes of the Emeril show from the Food Network library every other night of the week. For those of you who don't know, Fine Living is a sister channel to Food Network, and they end up showing selected Food Network shows that are into syndication now. Shows like Thirsty Traveler, Ming's Quest, Mario Batali's show, Molto Mario, stuff like that. I just never thought I'd see Emeril relegated to the minor leagues. If I were Bobby Flay, I'd be watching very closely right now. For all the bad things I've had to say about Food Network, they have had a few gems. Emeril Lagasse, for as over-the-top as he was, still kind of brought it, even toward the end. The man can simply cook, and there are few people on that network that could really cook anymore, so still have some respect for that man. I was sent this article from Rick at Pacific Brew News, sent me a link to this story from NPR about a French chef who's providing gourmet school lunches in schools. He starts each day at 5:30 in the morning when the fish market opens in the southern French provincial town of Salon-de-Provence. And on the day they did this report, he was picking up 20 pounds of fresh live mussels at the market. And then he heads off to the public high school and he cooks. At the school, he prepares meals for about 800 students uses all fresh local ingredients, you know, just like we like to talk about here on the show. And the introduction of healthy school lunch programs, just like his, is a major reason why France has been able to curb childhood obesity problems that they've been plagued with for about two decades. And they were on the rise for a long time. And now, through these school lunch programs, they're able to curb it.
Dominique Valadier starts his day at 5:30 a.m., just as the fish market opens in the southern French provincial town of Salon-de-Provence. Today, Valadier picks up 20 pounds of fresh live mussels before heading off to the Lampéry High School, where he is the cook. After their morning greeting and a few laughs, Valadier and his staff of four get going on the day's meal for about 800 students. On the menu today, mussels in cream sauce over rice with leeks and stuffed turkey thighs accompanied by a squash au gratin casserole. Nothing here is frozen or pre-prepared, says Valadier, hoisting a sack of the algae-covered mussels.
Voilà. Alors là, on a une étiquette.
Voilà. This sticker here shows where these mussels came from and when they were harvested. This guarantees their freshness.
Eyes twinkling and knives flashing, Valadier opens up the plump turkey thighs, cutting out the bones. He says you should be able to hear good cooking. The flattened turkey fillets are wrapped around a stuffing of ground-up parsley, garlic, cheese, and smoked pork shoulder. The loaves are then tied with twine and baked for 3 hours at low temperatures to keep in the juices and flavor. When sliced, they will serve hundreds of students, 10 times the number that could have been fed on the plain turkey thighs. Preparation and proximity are the keys to high-quality meals at lower prices, says Valadier.
On essaye de faire en sorte.
We try to get our base products, meat, fish, vegetables, within a 30-mile radius because there are fewer intermediaries and we can negotiate price and quality with the producer. These turkeys were raised and slaughtered just near here. If I have a problem, I'll ask the producer to come see me and I can guarantee you things will be a lot better the next time.
All around the school kitchen, pots and pans are cooking and simmering away. Gallons of bechamel sauce bubble for the squash casserole. A vat of chickpeas boils for homemade hummus. It's hard to believe this is a school cafeteria and not a three-star restaurant. Perhaps what's most impressive about Valadier's meals is that they cost students only $3 a day, less than the typical fast food fare served at many French high schools. Another way Valadier saves money is by getting maximum use out of every ingredient. He never throws anything away. In one corner of the kitchen, he is boiling down the fish heads, flesh, and bones from yesterday's salmon to make a tasty bouillon for today's mussels. As lunch hour begins and the students file in, Valadier joyfully serves them while answering questions about the meal. He reaches across the counter with a forkful of the squash au gratin to give 17-year-old Valentine Biemans a taste. Biemans says she and her friends have all but quit eating lunch at McDonald's and have discovered a lot of new dishes.
It's all the time different food and it's very, very good. People are really happy because it's really hard now to eat well and cheap.
Valadier left the world of glamorous Riviera restaurants for something more meaningful. He's clearly found his calling here. Daniel Vieux teaches drama and English at the high school.
We are very, very lucky because it's a real project. It's not just doing the cooking. It's a whole concept of educating and doing something good and taking time and enjoying it. And it's artistic at the same time.
Valadier says investing in the students' well-being is also an act of citizenship. If young people learn to eat well early on, he says, it will cost the country's healthcare system a lot less in the future.
I had a conversation with Rick about this, and of course, we're both really impressed with it and completely baffled why this can't be a standard practice here in the States. I mean, if there's a place where childhood obesity is a genuine issue, I think it's right here. And Rick brought up the segment that was in both Morgan Spurlock's movie Supersize Me, as well as Eric Schlosser's book Fast Food Nation, that our schools definitely have a problem. I mean, there was one school in Illinois that tried to teach kids how to make the right food choices by actually letting them choose what they were going to have for lunch themselves. And guess what happened when they did that? A majority of those kids ate French fries, potato chips, cookies, sweets. That was lunch. Now, some kids brought their lunches, but those that were given a choice, they chose crap. And one girl had two packs of Ruffles, a pretzel, a Twix bar, and a bottle of Gatorade. The big problem we have in the country here is this. If this French chef came to an American school and tried to feed American kids mussels for lunch, he'd need security to leave the building. They'd be stoning him out the door. I mean, American children aren't raised to eat seafood like that, or weird things like stuffed turkey legs over braised leeks. The kids would be like, where are my fries? I want a cookie. And the parents would raise a giant stink, and they'd try to sue the school. The reality of food in schools here in the United States is that food provision companies actually bid to win contracts with school districts. And in most cases, the lowest bidder will win every time because the schools are not provided with a really large budget. So gourmet lunches would more than likely be out of the question anyway. Would they really? I mean, if you think about the long-term health effects of leaving the nutrition of your kids in the hands of a company like Sodexo, which is a company that not only feeds over 400 school districts nationwide, but also runs the food programs for prisons, maybe forcing a healthier diet on children would serve them better. And companies that provide food to prisoners are also providing foods to your kids in school. I mean, really, think about it. Think about the quality of food being provided to your children. Nutritional items like Little Debbie snack cakes, Gatorade, candy bars. You can't leave food choices to kids and think they're going to make the right decisions. And it's not their fault. You just can't give them those kind of decisions to make. It's not food education. That's just opening the door to more obesity and more health issues. And I know we like to say that the French suck, but you have to admit this is a really great food program. Fresh, delicious, healthy, and best of all, cheap. It didn't cost them a lot to do this. Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. So after the last show, the Japa Dog show, I got an email from Rick Seller, Pacific Brew News, pacificbrewnews.com. Check them out. You're not believe this. He gave my address. I guess he got email by Marty Jones, who's the marketing guy over at Oscar Blues Brewery. You remember we had Dale's Pale Ale on the last show? I guess the distribution just started out here in Southern California, and he wanted him to talk about it. He goes, well, I'm in Northern California, but here's an address of somebody in Southern California. Gives him my email address. Marty sends me all this information. I said, dude, I just did your beer on my show, but I'd like to do more. Maybe we can talk about it and have you on the show or something. So we're going to do that. Marty emailed me back, sent me a bunch of information, said anytime I want to do it. So we're going to call him soon. And we're also going to be talking to Patrick Rue at the brewery here locally, hopefully with Rick from Big Foamy Head, and kind of do a dual thing there. So there's a lot of brewery stuff happening soon. But getting right to the point of this show, I have a beer from the Lost Abbey. And it's Carnevale. Carnevale, I don't know how they pronounce it. C-A-R-N-E-V-A-L-E. Carnevale Farmhouse Saison. It's a seasonal release that they release every winter. And luckily enough, it is released locally by Port Brewing. It's a long story. In 2005... Vince Marsaglia, who we've talked about before, was a co-owner of Pizza Port and Port Brewing. He decided to start a side brewing project called The Lost Abbey, which would only brew Belgian beer, which is perfect for me, right? Because you know I'm crazy for it. Of course, there's no real actual Abbey. It's just a name. But he had hired a brewer, Tommy Arthur, in 1997, and he worked at the Pizza Port in Solana Beach. And in November of that year, they released their first Belgian beer, Double Overhead Abbey Ale. Now, this led to a series of Belgian beers that they would produce all under the Port Brewing name. And every time they'd make one, it got really popular. And like I said before, you know, you walk into a Port Brewing or the brewery or a pizza port, you walk in there and there's going to be like 15 different beers on tap at any given time. And you go to each one, there'll be something different. I mean, they brew so many beers, it's not funny. Anyway, when they moved to the new San Marcos brewing facility that I told you about a couple episodes ago, we had the Hop 15, remember that? They were able to make more beer now that they had this big facility. It was the old Stone Brewing facility. And so they figured it'd be a good idea to make these Belgian beers special releases under the name Lost Abbey. They bottle these beers in big 750-milliliter bottles. I think that's what this is. It's a pint, 9.4 fluid ounces. It looks like one of those big 750s. It's like a regular Belgian beer. You know, it's got the cork, wire cage, the whole kit and caboodle. anything you'd expect from an Abbey-style Belgian beer, but best of all, brewed right here in the United States. And even better, brewed right here in California. So, lucky for me, I've got it right here in front of me. These things run about $10, and they're collectibles. I mean, people collect these beers. And Tommy Arthur wrote a really nasty letter to eBay that appeared in the back of Beer Advocate magazine a few months ago about how pissed off he was that people were selling his beer on eBay. And I thought it was kind of humorous. And I'm not sure if I can find that link online, but it was pretty funny. Anyway, let me pour this into a nice glass and we can try it together. Take off the wire cage. Look out. Here comes the blast. You know this is coming. The sound of beauty. It's a beauty, Clark. Listen. Well, that sounds good, huh? It looks nice. It's got a nice color. A little bit cloudy. Not, you know, completely pure. Oh, man, it smells Belgian. Right off the bat. The beauty of Belgian beer is that it smells distinct. And it's got that nice scent, that nice peppery aroma. Soft, perfumey. Very easy to drink. Excellent beer. A nice saison. Not too overly carbonated. You know, if I have a general problem with golden ales, it's that they're too highly carbonated. Duvel does that to me a lot. Gives me gas. The worst kind of gas. I'm belching and burping. It's tough to do a show when I'm drinking Duvel. This is moderately carbonated. My friend Gonzo used to like to say, I know you like flat beer. I don't like flat beer. I just don't like beer that's giving me gas and making me belch and, you know, you can hear my stomach the whole time. I just want a nice drink, and this has got just the right amount of funk. The beauty of Saison is that some Saisons are nuts. You know, you have some Saisons like Saison DuPont, or one of my favorites is Fantôme, which is a farmhouse Saison ale. It's got the funk in it. I mean, it's got some wild yeast. You can do that to Saison. It's so open to interpretation for brewers to do what they want to do with it that you could literally make it any way you want. As long as it's got the same color and, you know, a general scent and flavor, you're all over the map. So they're not tough to make. It's about 90% of it's in the yeast, but I don't know what they're doing with this. This some kind of special hops they're using. I know you don't want to sit around and listen to me drinking all day, so we'll move on to our next subject while I'm drinking. I'm packing a lot into this show, folks. I don't know how long this is going to be. I say that a lot. I just don't, and so we're going to just go with it, and when it ends, it ends. But I had talked on the last show of the first season before we celebrated our anniversary that I had gone an entire year and did not eat Mexican food. I was surprised to find that I hadn't done it. I did Cuban food, but ask any Cuban, that's not Mexican. So what I'm going to do is I said I would do our first Mexican show now, and we're going to, but it's not what you would expect because my first taste of Mexican food in Mexico were two things, street tacos and ceviche. I had never had ceviche. I had never had a street taco, and the ceviche knocked my socks off. It became my favorite thing in the world to eat, but I had not had it up to that point, and for years after, had not had it. This was the late 80s, and in the 80s in California, it was a popular destination for spring breakers, college kids that were on spring break, to go down to Mexico. If you had a lot of money, and that's probably true to this day, if you had a lot of mommy and daddy's money, you went to Cancun, and you celebrated spring break down there, you partied. And, you know, you generally raised havoc down there at a resort. But if you didn't have a lot of mommy and daddy's money or simply couldn't make it all the way down to Cancun, you went to Ensenada and a place called Papas and Beer, which is a little bar in downtown Ensenada. But the problem is that these kids would go down there for the weekend. And even if it wasn't spring break, just on a weekend, they'd go down there. They'd raise absolute hell. I mean, they would just vandalize things, make too much noise, get in fights. They'd be pissing in the sidewalks, puking, generally just being bastards. The public, the citizens of that area, got a little irritated. So, as well they should, because you think about it, if a bunch of Mexican students came down here to your town, went to one of your bars in town, granted spent a lot of money on beers and drinks and food and whatnot, but still, you know, raised a big stink, vandalized places, urinated on sidewalks, had sex wherever they wanted to, threw up, caused fights, and generally pissed on your city, I think that you would be well within your rights to say, you know, you need to leave. And they should. And I think that these kids overstayed their bounds. So by the time we got there, that was toward the late part of the 80s, they were already, you know, hip to the Americanos. And we were not really, I was looked at with a kind of a sore eye. So I didn't get the warm fuzzies there. But that really isn't the point of my story. We went to Mexico one day. We woke up early. I think it was like 4:30. We left, drove my car down there. You buy insurance before you go across the border. It's like $15 for the weekend. It's real cheap. But you buy American insurance in Mexico. And then you get across the border. You go through Tijuana because that's kind of a dirt town. And then you go to Rosarita. And whereas Rosarita, we kind of hung out there for the day and had some kids watch my car. Of course, these kids come up and like, we should watch your car. And I said, okay. My brother says, you should pay them to watch your car. So I pay them. And, you know, of course, they start sitting on my car as we walk off. I think, okay, my car is safe. You know, those kids took off in 5 minutes. You're paying them to get them to buzz off. So, because I figure if I didn't pay them, they'd throw rocks through my windows. Anyway, so we walk into town, and first thing my brother says, it's like 10:30 in the morning. My brother says, are you hungry? I said, yeah, I'd like some breakfast. So he takes me to this taco stand. These taco stands are like these rolling taco stands. It's like a dirty water hot dog stand you'd see in New York or Philly, and except they sell street tacos, which are corn tortillas with a little carne asada, a little cilantro, and some minced onion. And then those were like 50 cents a piece, and then a cup, a clear plastic cup, a little small cup of ceviche. And I'd never had it before. And my brother says, oh, this is raw fish that's cooked with lime juice and lemon juice. And then it's mixed with a bunch of vegetables. And it's kind of like a salsa with fish in it. So I tasted it. And I have to tell you something. This went to my toes. The tacos, the street tacos, were fantastic. Oh, also, you get these little mini Coronas. They're like 8 ounces. And at the time, of course, you know, I'm young, I'm drinking beer on the street. It's great. And Corona has its place in a city like that with food like this when it's hot. And it's not really that hot, but you're just kind of out there. It was unbelievable. It was maybe the best breakfast I ever had. 10:30 in the morning, I'm drinking a beer, eating 2 soft tacos, and eating a ceviche. And when I got to the bottom of the cup, I was sad because it was gone. I am telling you, I've never had it like that since, but I've had it a few times, and I usually try to make it myself. The key to making really good ceviche is getting the freshest fish possible. You necessarily have to get a certain type of fish, but you have to get fresh fish. And the key to fresh fish is this. If you're buying a whole fish and the fish's head is cut off, don't buy it, because the reason they cut the fish's head off is because the head looks like hell. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you look at a fish head to tell if the fish is fresh or not, the eyes should be kind of clear. If the eyes are cloudy or sunken in or gone, then that fish is dead. It's been dead for a while. Not only that, it stinks. Fish should not smell like fish. Fish should smell like the sea. If it smells like fish, it's not a dish. All right? Just remember that little slogan. So the key is to get fresh fish. I like to make my ceviche with either a white fish, like swordfish, which I'm going to use today, halibut, whatever you want to use. Some any kind of fleshy, mahi-mahi is another one you can use, or ahi tuna. Now, ahi tuna just happens to be a big thing in our house right now, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you this story. My wife, if any of you who know me personally, know that my wife is not a real big fish eater. And the reason for that is she was traumatized by her dad when she was younger. Her mom took off for a week. I don't know. She was like 10 or 11 years old. Her mom takes off for a week, right, to take care of her aunt. I guess her aunt was sick. And she takes off to go take care of her aunt. And while she's gone, the minute she walks out of the house, and mind you, I never met my wife's father because her dad died when she was like 19 years old. So I never got to meet the man. But he sounded like my kind of dude. I really would have liked to have met this guy. The minute his wife leaves the door and he's thinking, oh my God, I'm in charge of dinner every night? Damn, we're having salmon. This man loved salmon. Again, one of the reasons why I would like to know the guy, because salmon's one of my favorite fish too. So the first night they eat, grilled salmon. Second night, poached salmon. The third night, they're eating salmon burgers. They're eating salmon whatever, stew. And he's making salmon sandwiches. They eat salmon every night she was gone. By the time her mom got home, she said, I'd never want to eat salmon again. And you know what? She didn't. Because I guess her mom went through it too, because he did it to her once. And so that was it. So it's been a long time for me to get my wife into eating fish. And for the most part, orange roughy or any kind of flavorless white fish was pretty much all I could actually get by her. And when it came to anything else like salmon or tuna, I usually had to end up eating it by myself. But recently, my wife has started to eat ahi tuna seared, that's kind of raw in the middle, but seared. And now she's gotten to the point where she can actually eat it raw. So ahi sashimi. Any sashimi-grade fish will work. Ahi will definitely work in the dish I'm about to share with you. But I'm using swordfish. And the flavor of the fish will kind of help, you know, determine the flavor of your dish. But for the most part, this dish is pretty much like a fish salsa, like I mentioned before. What you basically need is a pound of fresh fish, okay? Smell it. If it smells like fish, put it down. If they don't let you smell it, you don't want it. Because if they're not going to let you smell it, that means it's bad. If it smells like fish, put it down. Don't make this dish. But get fresh fish and pay top dollar for it. You know, if you have to pay 18 or 25 bucks a pound, you know, you're paying for fresh fish. You go to a professional fish market or someplace that turns over fish in a hurry. Don't go to the grocery store. For the most part, they're going to sell you frozen fish or fish that's been sitting around for a while and usually stinks. From there, you'll need lemon juice, lime juice, some sea salt, fresh thyme, extra virgin olive oil, rice wine vinegar, some minced fresh garlic, cracked black pepper, some ground cumin, a medium tomato that you seed and dice, white onion, a green bell pepper, red or yellow bell pepper, or orange, sometimes you can find the orange, a jalapeno pepper, and some fresh cilantro. I put a recipe on the website. Download that. It's got the complete directions and your ingredient list. The key here to doing this is to buy fresh lemons and fresh limes. Don't use the bottled stuff. I've said it before, but it also bears repeating. Don't ever buy, like, you know, the bottled stuff, the cute little lime that has a lime juice in it. Buy a fresh lime. Really, the taste difference is completely, it's night and day. When you taste fresh lime juice or fresh lemon juice, it's the real deal. When you seed and dice a tomato, I'm not sure how many of you, you know, dice tomatoes, but you take the tomato, you cut it in half, take a big spoon, and kind of scoop all the seeds and the membrane out. So all you're left with is the inside, inside of the tomato, the flesh, and then the outside. No seeds, none of that other membrane. And then just slice that and chop it up into pieces. And that's about it. You want to seed and slice the bell pepper, both the green and the yellow or the red. And then the jalapeno pepper, you want to make sure you seed and dice that. Now, if you've got really big balls and you really want to make this a hot one, use some habanero or scotch bonnet, but don't go overboard. Jalapeno is plenty hot. You don't want to, you know, overspice this dish. You're not going to taste anything else. And that's about it. You want to just cut the swordfish into pieces. Half-inch cubes are good, or smaller if you want. Just depends on how good your knife skills are. Put it in a bowl. Add the lemon juice, the lime juice, the salt, and the thyme. Toss it into the fish really gently. You don't want to beat the fish up. Cover it with plastic wrap and then put it in the refrigerator and allow it to marinate for 2 hours. What the key here now is that this citrus is going to cook the fish. So you want fresh fish, and it's just going to be cooked by the citrus. It never really sees a flame. The acid in the lemon and the lime are going to cook the fish through for you. And in the meantime, while it's marinating and cooking in the refrigerator, you want to make the vinaigrette. In a separate bowl, you'll combine olive oil, rice wine vinegar, garlic, pepper, and cumin. Mix that real well, and then take the marinating fish out of the fridge. Drain the juice from it, completely drain it, and then gently add the fish to the bowl of the vinaigrette. Now, don't beat it up. Again, you want to mix it really gently. You don't want to cut the fish up. You don't want to chunk it or make, you know, mash out of it. Then add the tomato, the onion, the bell peppers, the jalapeno, and the cilantro. Mix that in gently, just kind of fold it in, cover it with plastic wrap, and allow that to marinate in the refrigerator for another 2 hours or longer. Okay? And then from this point, it's a done dish. You can have this in a bowl on its own, or you can have it with some tortilla strips. You can serve it as an appetizer or a side dish, or you could just have it as a snack. It is a perfect summer food. It's perfect with a beer like this Saison, any American-brewed Belgian Saison, or any light lager beer would also go well with this, but I think it's a really good summer dish. And again, you know, when it comes down to Mexican food, there are a lot of good things, and some things I will definitely hit on this show. Burritos, tacos, you know, enchiladas, chili rellenos, all the different soups, and the many different beautiful things from Mexico. But the thing that struck me the most was the Mexican ceviche. At the time, it was a beautiful time. We had a really good weekend. I drank too much. I had my first taste of tequila. I had excellent food. And I'll tell you, I was sick one night, woke up the next morning before we left. I went back to that taco stand, and I had another bowl, a little glass of this ceviche before we left. And I felt like too much of a good thing sometimes really is a really good thing. And I definitely had a situation like that. So give this a shot. If you're afraid of eating raw fish, this is not the case. You're cooking this fish with citrus, and it's a well done dish. I heard a rumor last week that Rachel Ray is working on a book of her memoirs. Evo My, or something like that. I mean, who the hell's going to read that? Read her memoirs? What's she got to say? I mean, aren't you supposed to write memoirs when you're 60? You know, when you're no longer famous? Because that brought me to this point. I'm thinking, why is she writing this novel now? She's still popular. You're supposed to write this like after your popularity has waned. I think by the time she's 60, people are going to say, Rachel, who? If it's a book I can read in 30 minutes, maybe I'll give it a shot. But I honestly think she knows she's not going to be famous for long, so she wants to bank it while she can. And nothing against Rachel Ray, but I don't like her. Oh, an awfully good beer here. Tommy Arthur, The Lost Abbey. These beers are released seasonally, so they'll make them all year long, but they only make certain beers all year long. So this Saison usually gets released in winter, probably like sometime mid-January. And it's available on shelves until, you know, late spring here in California. I'm not sure what their distribution is like, but you can check them out, lostabbey.com or portbrewing.com, and find out what their distribution is going to be like. Okay, so I don't know if you'd call this the main event, because I think the ceviche kind of was the main event, but I wanted to cover this year's hot dog eating contest. Full coverage. Most of you who listen to the show regularly know my disdain for the whole idea of competitive eating. I mean, even though it's mostly tongue-in-cheek, it's still kind of an absolutely ridiculous, over-the-top show of stupidity. And I refuse to call it a sport, as they seem to do. And I mean, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, the annual Nathan's Coney Island Hot Dog Eating Contest was a really big thing. It was a special event. Celebrate the 4th of July with Americans, and they can all get behind it. And I don't mean to sound like a stick in the mud here, okay? I know you like want to call me a fuddy-duddy, or, you know, that I'm being too serious. But the world right now is faced with widespread food shortages, starvation, general food crisis. So I feel that maybe it would kind of be in good taste to stop televising events like this and sticking it in the face of everybody about how opulent and rich we are. And maybe concentrate your efforts on helping world hunger in another way. This past weekend, ESPN televised the 2008 Hot Dog Eating Championship, which is sponsored by Nathan's, which is a company that makes wieners that are really big. And I decided to TiVo it so I could share the stupidity of this thing with all of you on the show. I had never sat and watched it in its entirety before. And let me tell you right now, I wasn't missing a damn thing all these years, and trust me, neither are you. This thing was an hour long. I chopped it into 8 minutes, plus my commentary, because you know I'm going to comment on it. Besides the general idea of eating as many hot dogs as you can in 10 minutes, which I kind of feel is arrogant anyway, showing the world that we're so rich with food that we make an event out of it, I was kind of shocked that the announcers made sports references and comparisons to other sporting events and other athletes through the entire thing. And if they were really tongue-in-cheek, because I think they were, but if they really were, because I'm only assuming that they were, you know, making jokes, because they never really let on, I wish they'd have at least laughed a little bit when they made these jokes, just so I knew that they were joking. Because, you know, we all bust balls, call each other a fruit or whatever, but, you know, we joke when we do it. We're not serious. Because you listen to this. I mean, listen, it sounds like they're dead serious about this thing being a sport. Even the commercial for Nathan's that I put in the beginning, it sounds like they're trying to emulate the spirit of the NFL.
They come from the four corners of the globe. Gustatory athletes competing in a near 100-year-old tradition to win the coveted yellow mustard belt. Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs. Famous hot dog taste. Famous hot dog quality. Famous since 1916. It's the hot dog of champions. Nathan's Famous. There can be only one.
There it is, the historic corner of Cirque and Stillwell. We're in Brooklyn, right at Coney Island, not all that far from the beach, ready to go with the start of the 2008 Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest. Down on the beach, they're getting ready for their 4th of July. We hope you are as well. You got it going on the grill for you. And let me tell you, the fans have just absolutely jammed in here once again. The crowd gets bigger and bigger each year as we count down to the very first bite in competition. Weather's been a little bit iffy. We had some showers in the morning.
So what's the weather got to do with this? You know, it's not like they're playing baseball or football, but I think if you wanted to call this a sport, you should make them compete in the middle of like a massive hurricane or something, like Hurricane Katrina. Then maybe I could see the challenge, and you can call it a sport. You know, try eating hot dogs while the scaffolding of what used to be a house comes hurling at your face. Then it's a sport. Oh, the hot dog's up! Holy shit, did you see that? He ate it!
Now it's just hot, it's muggy, but it's not slowing this crowd down whatsoever. And inside in the kitchens at Nathan's Famous, they are cooking the dogs on the grill, and they're going to need hundreds of them because there are 21 competitors ready to gobble those things down. Nathan's Famous, and we welcome you. It's such a great 4th of July tradition. I'm Paul Page with Rich Shea, and what we're talking about here is all about the rematch. Kobayashi and Joey Chestnut.
Oh, yeah, so this Kobayashi guy, he was the 5-year reigning champ of competitive eating until this American kid, Joey Chestnut, beat him last year. And they were saying Kobayashi has this jaw injury, and he had to see a physician, and he was training hard to get his jaw rehabilitated. Just absurd.
The two greatest eating champions of all time, Paul. Joey Chestnut won last year with 66 hot dogs and buns. He did it against a Kobayashi with an injured jaw. I call Chestnut an American hero.
An American hero. Dude, come on. My friend Tracy just got back from his tour in Iraq with his unit, who all came back safely, I should mention. That's an American hero. I wouldn't even make this joke. Considering what the country's going through right now, I maybe would have made a retraction or thought about that a little bit. American hero.
But he must win this year to avoid the asses. Now, Kobayashi in this ADD-riddled society, 6 straight victories. He lost last year. He's all but fallen off the map. He is nothing if not a brand. To maintain that brand, he must win today.
Yeah, and the expression of the sport, they say he hasn't eaten since last October. We want to take you back the final minutes of last year when Joey Chestnut was just powering on, going hard, and Kobayashi hit the wall. And in fact, he had an unfortunate moment. It required a judge's consultation.
Unfortunate moment, yeah. That guy looked like he was going to hurl. He looked like a squirrel. He had all this crap hanging out of his mouth, these big giant cheeks, and one eye open. He's like, oh, dear God.
And when it was over, the belt had come back to the United States.
Absolute great moment in American sports.
Great moment in American sports, dude. And let me think here for a second. Great moments in American sports. Boston finally wins a World Series. New York Giants upset New England in the Super Bowl. Ruins a perfect season for the Patriots. Fresno State, earlier this year, unseeded coming into the College Baseball World Series, wins the whole thing. Wilt Chamberlain scores 100 points against the Knicks. Lance Armstrong wins 7 Tour de France in a row. Michael Jordan hits clutch threes with no time on the clock. And Joey Chestnut eating 62 hot dogs in 12 minutes. All great moments in American sports.
66 was impressive. Now, if Kobayashi's jaw was indeed injured, he did 63. They're talking 70 today.
So now they're going to talk to Joey Chestnut before the contest. And you know how they do the interview. They interview the athlete before the event. And to this guy's credit, he's playing it all up. He's hamming this thing. They ask him later if he considers himself an athlete, and he just laughs at him.
Let's go to Jimmy Dykes. He has Joey Chestnut.
I'm here with the current world record holder, Joey Chestnut, the number one ranked eater in the world. But for the first time here in about 30 minutes, Joey, you're going to step up to the plate over here with a lot of pressure on you to defend your title. How does that pressure affect you right now?
I'm not looking at it as pressure. It's all support. There's 30,000 New Yorkers out here supporting me and pushing me to my limit, and I'm just going to celebrate 4th of July with all of them and hopefully come out with a victory.
What's your limit today?
It's hard to say, but if my body's cooperating, we're looking at a new record.
All right, congratulations. Good luck.
Thank you.
Well, for more on the Tiger Woods of eating, let's go back to Paul Page.
The Tiger Woods of eating. Holy crap, dude. You know, if you want to keep it in context, the Tiger Woods of eating is actually John Daly. I mean, look at that, dude. And while I'm on the subject, you knew the minute Tiger announced he was going to have knee surgery and wouldn't play again this year in the PGA, that the PGA itself had a collective heart attack. Who cares? Right? No one's going to watch. I saw footage last week at a Pro-Am event with John Daly and Kid Rock in overalls. And Daly's teeing off on a 22-ounce can of Coors Light. He hits his ball. The can just flies. It goes flying into the crowd, sprays cheap beer on everybody. And then he says he was upset because it was the last can in his six-pack. Big tall boy. Do they make those in six-packs? Unbelievable. The Tiger Woods of eating. I love that.
In the heart of Northern California, we visit a gentleman, Joey Chestnut, at ease with himself and enjoying some fishing. Here are his thoughts on the victorious outing he had while eating 66 hot dogs and buns last year.
What type of competitor or athlete are you?
Athlete.
See? The guy asks him what kind of athlete he is, and he can't stop laughing. A dude eats hot dogs. He's not an athlete. You ought to see my cat eat tuna. You want to talk about an athlete? He'll eat you out of house and home. Now, there's some competitive eating.
And we want to show you a comparison, too, between Muhammad Ali and Kobayashi.
Yeah, well, you know, Ali was awesome, but Kobayashi can't rhyme, I should note. He can eat better than Ali ever could, but he cannot rhyme or rap.
Oh, no, they didn't. Comparing Kobayashi to Muhammad Ali. Yeah, there's a comparison. You know, I think at this point, Ali in his current state could probably put both of these clowns down on the mat.
At the podium, and here we go. We're ready for the countdown.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin!
The eating begins.
You know, out of the gate here, Paul, I wouldn't be surprised to see a 10 or an 11 hot dog minute out of Joey and Kobayashi. They attack those dogs like Lindsay Lohan attacks a minibar. It's completely reckless in the first few minutes.
Okay, now you see, this is where I think it's a total joke. The Lindsay Lohan reference. Now, that's completely scripted. It's a joke. It's a bad joke, but it's a joke. Now, I'm going to fast forward a little bit here because I want to get through the rest of this.
Both are bouncing down the food as best they can. Kobayashi and Chestnut. One dog difference with 30 seconds to go.
This is amazing. This is probably one of the most exciting finishes in all of sports.
Oh, yes. The most exciting finishes in all of sports. I so agree. It's so exciting. I can't wait to see who's going to puke first.
Definitely in all of Coney Island hot dog eating history right here.
And we count the final 15 seconds now.
This could go OT.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
And that's it.
That is a photo finish right there, Paul.
How do you have a photo finish with the dogs?
We've gone overtime before. It'll be the judge's call down there. What's in the mouth, of course, counts at the very end. As long as you swallow it.
All right, so now the contest is over, and it's a tie between Kobayashi and Chestnut. Here's the announcer.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Here's the word.
At the end of our 10-minute regulation, we have come to an absolute, complete tie.
A tie.
Never before in Coney Island have we come to a tie.
Hot dogs and buns. Ladies and gentlemen, bring up 5 more hot dogs and buns each.
It'll be a 5-dog eat-off. That looks like the call. Unbelievable. The fans not disappointed. The most evenly matched game in the history of Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest, a history that goes back to 1916. Never before have we seen this.
Let's go, give me those hot dogs now.
And now it's about speed.
And so here come the additional five. When they stop like this, though, does that affect their ability to get back into the five left?
Well, you know, my wife always tells me, you know, don't eat it all so quickly.
Oh, hey, dude, maybe she wasn't talking about hot dogs.
Perhaps take a couple bites and pause and see if maybe your stomach could tell your mind you're full. So I think there is some merit to that. But these guys, of course, are different animals. Now, who's going to eat them quicker?
So now they're going to have a five hot dog eat-off, or a five dog eat-off, whatever they call it. Whoever finishes all five dogs first wins. And mind you, these are just dogs on a bun. And they have these cups of water that they're all dripping the dogs in, and they're drinking the water to wash it down. And there's bun crumbs and meat pieces all over their face and their shirts. And these aren't like regular beef dogs. These are like lips and asshole type dogs. I mean, so it's a real mess.
These are precious few seconds, precious seconds.
Whoa, and they just flipped Kobayashi over to four.
Because he can cannonball. They can cannonball. Kobayashi just gets it down.
And Joey matches him. We're going for the last dog now. Kobayashi's pushing it in. Joey's pushing it.
Joey Chestnut looks to be done.
Joey Chestnut. Wow, Joey Chestnut.
The passion is raw, but the hot dogs are cooked. That's the most amazing competitive eating contest I have ever seen. And Kobayashi is absolutely crestfallen. He brought everything he had to Coney Island today. He's a great competitor, a gracious man. But Joey, it would appear, is going to maintain the title.
And like Tiger Woods just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh my God, with the Tiger Woods references, come on. Tiger Woods played five rounds of pressure golf at Torrey Pines on a knee that was destroyed and had to beat Rocco Mediate on the last hole of a playoff in the entire round to win the U.S. Open. Somehow, I just don't see the comparisons here.
It's Joey Chestnut who retains the mustard belt. He is the champion of the Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest. Joey Chestnut has done it. He ate through the 59 and then five in the shootout. We'll be back.
Oh, no, we won't. That's that. I know I'm taking it all too literally. I'm a stick in the mud. It's an obvious joke, but I just don't see the humor in it. We've got a real life crisis on our hands. Stuff like this is happening all around us. We've played this before.
With fires still burning, Haitian residents collect what they can from a smoldering marketplace. Angry over rising food prices, demonstrations turned violent in recent days, raising tensions as conditions in Haiti deteriorate.
Sorry to be a bummer. I just don't find it funny. SeriousEats.com is one of my favorite sites on the internet, and they often run stories that give me ideas for my show, so I wanted to kind of give them a shout out. SeriousEats.com, I go there daily, has always got great news on there. One of the key features that they have on their site now is a series with Mario Batali called Unclogged, and it's a video series. Now listen, I've said it before, and it definitely bears repeating. Mario Batali, the greatest thing going on Food Network. He's a real chef. He's a wealth of knowledge, and I don't think Food Network ever deserved him. They definitely didn't deserve the show that he did, Molto Mario. And when they relegated it to Fine Living, it hurt Food Network, and it made Fine Living better. And that's fine with me. But I wanted to play this clip from Unclogged, where Mario explains how pasta should properly be sauced. Now, I know this has nothing to do with our show now, but I think it's a topic I've hit on before, and I just kind of found it funny because it kind of bears repeating, and he makes a reference to hot dogs, and it makes sense. And I wish I could get my mother-in-law to listen to this, because she drives me batshit crazy every time I bring her pasta. She'll say, does this have sauce on it? I mean, I sauced it. I just didn't oversauce it. I mean, some Americans and their pasta, they don't get it. If it's not buried in sauce, it's not good. And what they fail to realize is that a plate of pasta is really only about the pasta, not the sauce. The sauce is a condiment. And as Mario explains in this clip, it's a condiment like you would use on a hot dog.
The relationship between pasta and sauce is tenuous at best. Often overdone in America, never underdone in Italy. I think the most important thing for people to realize is what you want to eat when you eat a bowl of pasta is pasta. And the way that they refer to their saucing in Italy is by the word condimento, condiment. When you think about a hot dog or a hamburger, the condiment is something that kind of greases it up, but it never overtakes the flavor of the main event of a hot dog or a hamburger. And the sauce, in fact, is exactly that. A sauce should just cling to the noodle, very much like salad dressing to a perfectly dressed salad. That is to say, there's nothing on the bottom, but each one of the leaves or the noodles is just dressed enough that the wheat, the depth of the flavor of the grain, which is the absolute heart of the agrarian Italian society, is the most important thing. And when you taste that, and it's cooked perfectly, that is to say al dente, which is crunchier than Americans ever think it is, when it's tasting like that and it feels like that, you get a mouthfeel that exudes both the wheatness of the grain, of the actual noodle itself, and expresses the beauty of the condiment or the sauce. That is to say, Americans overdress their pasta 99.9% of the time. It should never be a bowl of soup. It should be noodles with a little stuff.
Amen, brother man. You see? Would you eat a hot dog buried in mustard and ketchup? Hell no, you wouldn't. So why are you burying your pasta in sauce? Maybe it's because your pasta sucks. You know, it tastes like a wet dog. Because it's true, the cheap pasta, that tastes bad. I've smelled it. It's not good. Try fresh pasta. Don't buy generic stuff. Spend the extra 50 cents for the more expensive dried pasta in the grocery store. You know, spend good money on good fresh pasta or try making your own, maybe. Just don't bury it in sauce anymore. It's an insult to the pasta. I just find it really funny that the same people who complain about a lack of pasta sauce are people who try to come off as finicky eaters or special eaters when it comes to things like salad or sandwiches. They're like, ooh, dressing's a little heavy. You know, you put too much mustard on the sandwich. Dude, please. Anyway, thanks Serious Eats as always. SeriousEats.com. Check it out. You know, I think my work here is done. This beer's starting to get to my head a little bit. I think it might be my longest show ever. In fact, I'm looking. Yeah, it's my longest show ever. Any of you who complain about short shows? Well, here you have it. This is what it sounds like when I ramble on forever. Mm-mm. Lost Abbey, Carnival, Saison, good. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening to me bitch about the hot dog eating contest. I know, I've got no sense of humor. I strongly urge any of you who likes seafood, try making this ceviche sometime, all right? It's really good. It's authentically Mexican. It's the perfect summer appetizer for your next party. Delicious. Just make sure you buy fresh fish. Nothing stinky. Remember, if it smells like fish, it's not a dish. Thanks to the Lost Abbey, Port Brewing for the Carnival Saison, portbrewing.com, lostabbey.com. Music in this episode, Someone Must Get Hurt by She Wants Revenge. Check the website, zeroface.wordpress.com. I put a link to the iTunes store. Buy the song, support the band who supports our podcast, and beersafari.com. Beer Safari, it's a jungle of beer. Should I drink that.com? Enter their contest, win a new car and a new house and a mansion on the hill. Thanks again for tuning in yet again. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see you on the other side. Ciao.
I'll call for the witness, present the facts right down. They say the heart is resilient in black.